case on the calendar today is A19-0630, Tony Flatum versus Protec Restoration and Brian Jovan. Hope I pronounced those names correctly. You can let me know if I mispronounced any of them. Thank you. Council will each have 15 minutes for your argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. You can go ahead and proceed when you're ready. If you could identify yourself for the record, I'd appreciate it when you start your argument.
Thank you, Judge. Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Scott Wilson. Seated on my right is Courtney Ernston. Together we represent the appellant in this case, Brian Jovan, and he is also with us in the courtroom today. This case presents a relatively novel issue of pre-incorporation contract law, where two people clearly understand that one of them is to become an employee of a new corporation that's yet to be formed. Is the one forming the corporation personally liable for later breach of that contract? Initially, Brian Jovan and Tony Flatum planned to form the storm restoration company, Protec, together. They were originally co-promoters of the corporation. When Brian Jovan discovered that Tony Flatum had consent decrees entered against him at the Department of Labor and Industry, it was no longer desirable to form essentially a partnership with Tony Flatum in the corporation, and instead he agreed to hire Flatum as a key employee of the new corporation.
But was any of this promoter liability issue ever raised before the district court?
Not by name, and that is a concern. It's something I was going to address affirmatively if you hadn't asked about it, Judge Hooten. We didn't specifically raise the issue of defenses to promoter liability before the district court. And I want to say just a little bit about that. The doctrine of promoter liability is unique, it's not unique, but it's unusual in that it is, on the one hand, a black letter principle, and on the other hand, relatively obscure. In 37 years of practice, I've not encountered it. I've taken an informal poll of commercial litigators. I haven't found one who's encountered it. And in this case, we had five capable lawyers who didn't encounter it, except at the very end, not at the 11th hour, but I would say at 11:59, Mr. McGilligott uttered one sentence in oral argument referring to the Larson Treatise section on promoter liability. What matters for purposes of this court's review, though, is that we did make substantially similar arguments below. We argued that the record can't support a finding of personal liability in Brian Jovan.
This is in post-trial motions?
That's correct.
Was the concept incorporated into the jury instructions?
It was not incorporated into the jury instructions, Judge.
And don't we evaluate the evidence with respect to the jury instructions?
I think you evaluate the evidence that way, but truthfully, you don't evaluate the law that way. And this appeal is principally from the district court's denial of judgment as a matter of law.
Right, but I mean the case law says that the jury instructions are the law of the case. And so if you're on a post-trial motion for JNOV, JMOL, the appellate court should look at the jury instructions as the governing law and should determine whether the evidence satisfies the criteria in the instructions.
I think that is one view. I think that the court also has discretion to review legal issues that are not specifically raised below.
What's your authority for that?
The authority for that is laid out in our reply brief. Well, specifically, you know, actually, there's this court's case in 2008, Kunze versus St. Mary's Regional Health Center, is a good summary of the court's discretion to address issues that are not specifically raised below. And, you know, what this court and the Supreme Court has traditionally said is that there's a well-established exception to the reviewability principle, which is it's got to be raised below. And that is where the issue is one that is purely legal and wholly dispositive of the case. This court has the discretion to review. It doesn't have to, but it can. And this case, I assert, perfectly fits that exception. The promoter liability issues that we've raised on appeal are wholly dispositive of the case. They are relatively novel legal issues. They are issues that are raised prominently in briefing before this court by both parties. And they are issues that are implicit in arguments that we raised below, which, as I was saying, were that the record doesn't support a finding of personal liability in Brian Jovan, and that any obligation to Tony Flatham is owed by his employer.
Well, could we just
Pro-Tech.
Go, if we could just go, I assume you're referring to the Watson factors?
That's correct.
All right, so.
As expressed by this court in the
So if we go factor by factor, what support do you believe supports our review of this matter? Under the Watson factors?
Well,
what evidence can you point us to?
Yeah, factor by factor. As I say, first of all, if this court agrees with our arguments on promoter liability as properly applied in this state, that argument is wholly dispositive of the judgment against Brian Jovan because the court would agree with us that the judgment should be against him, making him personally liable, should be overturned. Secondly, while the courts of the state have touched on promoter liability in a small handful of older cases, it is a relatively novel and undeveloped area of law. Thirdly, the issues were raised. There was engagement here before this court. Fourth,
How was the issue raised, though? I mean, what can you point us to in this record that indicates the issue was raised? If I'm hearing you, you're saying, well, we didn't use the magical words of promoter liability, but we did make the arguments.
I wish it was quite that clean.
Okay.
You know, I'm not going to stand here straight-facedly and say, well, we made exactly the same arguments substantively before the district court that we're making now. What I'm saying is that we made arguments that were akin to promoter liability
arguments. What arguments did you make that were akin to?
Yeah, and those arguments were specifically that the record can't support a finding of personal liability in Jovan because the relationship was between Flatham and the new corporation, Pro-Tech.
And how is that akin to the promoter liability arguments you're raising now?
I would say it's akin to it because the promoter liability argument is a doctrine that contextualizes that problem. We were addressing the same problem before the district court. We were saying essentially in the post-trial hearing, how can this be? In a circumstance like this one, where Tony Flatham is clearly the employee of Pro-Tech, and the complaint is a breach of that contract of employment, how is it that Mr. Jovan can have personal liability? The record doesn't support personal liability in Brian Jovan. Promoter liability places a legal framework around that argument. So that's my explanation of how that argument is akin.
So the parties jointly submitted proposed jury instructions, right?
That is correct.
On September 14, about 10 days before trial. I mean, I've reviewed them. I don't see anything in there remotely similar to this theory that you're arguing to us now. Then the parties submitted their evidence. So now that, you know, the parties submitted their evidence based upon the issues and theories that they understood to be at issue, which are reflected in the jury instructions, right?
That's correct.
And so now after the record has been closed, you want to raise a new theory for the first time that, you know, and isn't that unfair to the party that has already submitted their evidence?
I would assert no, for two reasons. First of all, I see the problem that you're pointing to, and I'm not here to tell you that the way that this case proceeded below is desirable. But the reason that I do not believe it presents unfairness is because my opponent, our arguments are fundamentally not evidentiary. Yes, we are making an argument about expert Chermak's foundational sufficiency. And yes, we're making a secondary argument for a new trial. But our argument is essentially that there is no legal justification for the verdict.
Yeah, but you're moving the target. I mean the jury instructions said these are the issues. These are the issues the jury is going to be asked to decide, and the jury did so. And then now you're saying that their evidence didn't meet some other standard that was never raised, that the plaintiff never had a chance to consider when presenting their evidence or when making their closing argument.
That's true. And I would sit down quietly in the face of that assertion, except that the jury is the finder of fact. And that problem is essentially a problem for development of the record. The problem here is legal. And the reason that I assert that what's happened in this case, while not desirable, is not unfair to Tony Flatim is because, first of all, Tony Flatim elected to pursue only Brian Jovan in breach of contract and for promissory estoppel. And secondly, because he had a full opportunity to argue the law at the post-trial motion and here, based on the record. I don't see the legal problem as a record issue. If the court does, I respect that. But my position here is that the court is looking at a legal issue of promoter liability and has the choice to review or not.
I'd like to spend a little bit of time on the damages issue or the profits issue. So what was defendant's closing argument with respect to whether the profits had been shared or not shared?
Our position, I can't cite you to the closing argument as I stand here, Judge. It is in the transcript. Our position.
I couldn't find the transcript of the closing argument. I'm not sure if that was requested or ordered. But anyway.
There is one in the record, Judge. There was some complication early on. We had a transcript produced. I wasn't involved in ordering it. There was a transcript produced for the sake of getting it quickly, which you have to do in post-trial proceedings.
Yeah. Well, did defend
included opening and closings. But to answer your question,
was defendant's trial theory that the contract wasn't breached because all profits were shared?
That is correct. That is correct. Certainly, our position at trial was that this was a profit-sharing agreement.
But that would be on a cash basis.
That's correct.
But can you tell me how would that be fair if in fact the work had all been done or partially done, Mr. Flatim had actually helped do the work, and you have this day he was terminated, and somehow for that work he doesn't get to, you know, for any day after his termination, he doesn't get to share in the profits even though he did the work.
Well, I mean,
is that, how is that fair?
I think truthfully, Judge Hooten, some money was owed. And there was a negotiation between the two men that fell apart, and it resulted in the lawsuit. And I'm not well focused on the closing arguments, so I may have misrepresented our position in saying that our position was that there was no damages. The problem we have with the verdict in this case, if we get away from the promoter liability issue, is the way that expert Chermak calculated those damages. We're not attacking here on appeal the fact that damages were awarded.
Your client, though, didn't present a rebuttal expert witness on
damages. That
is true. And you had an opportunity to cross Mr. Flatim's.
That is true as well.
So how can you be heard now to argue that there isn't support in the record for that damage award?
The state of our cross-examination and our choice to present an expert or not present an expert does not relieve the opposing party from its duty to present expert testimony that is properly founded.
But in what way wasn't there a foundation for it? I mean, I think he explained how he calculated his damage award, you just didn't agree with the approach. But that doesn't mean there isn't a foundation for it.
Well, there's a judgment call that the district court and this court makes in assessing foundational sufficiency. I assert there are two problems here. First, there is the issue of using accrual-based accounting to assess profit in a business that simply does not use it. And the use of that accrual basis, which is a tool not suited to its purpose, which is a foundational issue when an expert uses such a tool, that led the expert to use a non-accounting document, the Exhibit 22 jobs list, and then that led to additional problems because what the expert did he totaled the replacement cash value column in that document, which inflated the amount of profit. Judge?
But did your client at any time during the course of this trial make an objection to the methodology of the experts that the expert utilized?
Not during trial. That objection was made in pretrial motions and limine proceedings, and the court did definitively rule on that objection. It overruled the objection and allowed the expert
to
testify.
But I'm just reading, as I understand the objection, the district court said, as I understand the objection, was it more to the conclusions or that it involved more the conclusions? I think that's an argument that's being made by respondents here, that there was an objection to the conclusions, but not specific to the methodology.
I have to sit down and look at my brief. But my recollection is that the objection we made in the motion in limine went specifically to calculation, went specifically to methodology, and maybe I'm wrong about that. I'll look at the issue as I'm sitting down and awaiting rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
Thank you. Respondent, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Phil Kaplan, and I'm here with my partner, Art Boylan, from the Anthony Oslin Law Firm, and we represent the respondent, Tony Flatham. This case is about a profit-sharing agreement between Mr. Flatham and Mr. Jovan. After an almost week-long trial, the jury found Mr. Jovan personally liable for breaching that agreement. Mr. Jovan's unhappy with that verdict, which is understandable, but he doesn't get a do-over. There was plenty of evidence in the record to support the jury's verdict. And it's for the jury, not any court, this court or the trial court, to weigh the evidence or weigh the witness's credibility at trial. After trial, the trial court properly deferred to the jury verdict and denied Mr. Jovan's post-trial motions for a new trial and for judgment as a matter of law, and this court should affirm. So
I'm wondering, before you launch into it, the jury's verdict on promissory estoppel, was that an advisory verdict or was that binding? Was it tried by consent?
I don't know the answer to that question. I was not trial counsel. One of the trial counsel here could better answer
okay.
that.
That's okay.
I would like to address the issue of whether the promoter liability exceptions were raised below, because that was some of the first questions that the court asked of the appellant. The appellant admits that there was no jury instruction on these promoter liability exceptions. They admit that they never made this argument in post-trial motions before the trial court. It just wasn't raised below at all. So they're asking this court to decide a brand new issue that wasn't raised below, and this court can't do that. The court has discretion at times to address new issues on appeal, but this isn't a case where the court should exercise that discretion. And I have a few points on that. Number one, this is an error-correcting court, and as an error-correcting court, with all due respect, this court cannot adopt new law in Minnesota. That's for the legislature, that's for the Minnesota Supreme Court. And what appellant is asking this court to do is to adopt new exceptions to promoter liability law that are supported by Texas law or Georgia law, not Minnesota law. And this court simply doesn't have the authority to do that. Number two, appellant-
But should we even deal with the issue in light of the failure to raise promoter liability and the adoption of this new law before the district court?
No. The Court of Appeals should not deal with this issue at all. It should affirm the liability verdict on the basis that the issue that they're raising now wasn't raised below. To the extent this court is considering addressing those issues, you know, another problem is that this is not actually a novel legal principle, and it's not undeveloped, it's not unclear in Minnesota what promoter liability is and what the bounds are and what the exceptions are. We cited a few cases in our brief that deal with promoter liability, and that's the Almack case from this court, the State versus Industrial Tool case from the Minnesota Supreme Court, the PIML case, which is a federal district court case applying Minnesota law. All those cases are consistent with the jury verdict here and with Mr. Flatham's theory of the case. Another point I want to make is that promoter liability is really not that unique. It's actually perfectly consistent with other areas of the law that are developed in Minnesota, including agency law and assignment or novation law. So let me explain on the agency piece. Before a corporation is formed, it can't have an agent. A non-existent principal can't have an agent. So when the promoter is entering into an agreement, it can't say that I made this agreement on behalf of a corporation that doesn't exist yet. The promoter is individually liable, and that's consistent with plain black letter agency law in Minnesota. The other piece of this is, once the corporation is formed, it's possible for the promoter to assign his pre-incorporation agreement to the corporation, or it's possible for the corporation to adopt that agreement. But the promoter isn't left off the hook. The promoter is still on the hook individually for that agreement. And that's novation or assignment law. In assignment law, you can assign in your obligations under an agreement, but you remain on the hook. In order to be taken off the hook, it has to be a novation. And for novation to apply, both parties need to agree that the original obligor, the assignor, is released. And in this case, there's no evidence of that. The evidence at trial, taken in the light most favorable to Mr. Flatham, in the light most favorable to the verdict, including all inferences from the evidence, show that Mr. Flatham expected that Mr. Jovan would remain on the hook. He didn't care who paid him. It was going to be Mr. Jovan or the company. So this is not a novel legal theory. I also want to address the argument that...
But the record shows that all the payments were made by Protech to Mr. Flatham, correct?
That's correct, but that's not dispositive. All that shows is that the corporation adopted this agreement, but Mr. Jovan remains personally liable. That's promoter liability law, and as I mentioned, that's also novation or assignment law in Minnesota. Below, the appellants are arguing that they made arguments akin to promoter liability law. But that's not true, and I'm going to point the court to the post-trial hearing transcript. It's from December 11th, 2018, at page 4. The argument that appellant made below was, the first problem is that there is no evidence that Mr. Jovan personally made any promise, contractual or otherwise, to Mr. Flatham. So they were arguing about evidence. They said no evidence exists that would allow the jury to find Mr. Jovan personally liable. They weren't arguing about the law. They weren't arguing about jury instructions or how the court should, what kind of law the court should adopt in this case. It was all about the evidence. The last point I want to make is that if the court were to adopt these exceptions, it would not be dispositive in this case. All it would do is raise more fact issues that need to be decided by the jury. And I think Judge Johnson touched on the prejudice element of this. If appellants had raised these exceptions before trial and asked for a jury instruction, and the court had entered a jury instruction that adopted these exceptions, then Mr. Flatham's counsel would have asked different questions at trial or additional questions at trial to get at these exceptions. But because the exceptions weren't at issue, we had a different trial, a different scope of the evidence.
Which you claim is a reason we shouldn't even consider this argument.
Exactly. The court should not consider this argument, and the court should affirm the denial of the judgment as a matter of law. Now, if the court has no further questions on that, we can move on to the expert testimony. The first problem with the appeal related to expert testimony is that the appellants didn't preserve their objections below. And you can see that from their motion in limine brief, from the trial transcript, and even from some of the arguments today. In the motion in limine brief and in the pretrial transcript, you'll see a lot of arguments from the appellants about whether or not the expert, Mr. Shermack, was presenting improper opinions as facts, or facts as opinions, whether he was raising legal conclusions, whether he understood the agreement between the parties. But what you won't see is any objection to his reliance on this jobs list, which was Exhibit 22. And you won't see any arguments about his use of accrual-based accounting versus cash-based accounting. They simply didn't raise those issues below. And that changes the standard of review here. Instead of the more deferential abuse of discretion review, it's a plain error review. And there simply wasn't plain error here. This isn't a case where admitting Mr. Shermack's expert testimony was contrary to a well-established case law precedent or a rule or a standard of conduct.
All right. Are you claiming, did they or did they not make an objection based on the methodology of the expert?
They did not. And they certainly didn't make an objection similar to what they're making now on appeal. The second problem with the appeal related to the expert testimony is that all of their criticisms of Mr. Shermack's methodology go to its weight, not its admissibility. They're basically saying, we don't like the way he calculated, he should have calculated it a different way. But that's something for the jury to decide. The jury looks at the evidence, and if there's any reasonable basis for Mr. Shermack to reach the conclusion he reached or to use the methodology he used, then it was properly admitted and the jury properly weighed it.
Could I ask you this? I mean, and I don't know if this came up during the trial, but in determining which, whether the cash method or the accrual method of determining these damages was appropriate, on the other side, I mean, is the accrual method the best method here? Because if they don't collect from these people that they've done these jobs for whatever reason, maybe they've gone bankrupt, maybe they're just avoiding payment. I mean, is it fair to shift all that risk of collection under the accrual method to Mr. Jovan?
It is fair. And
why don't we address that? Because
okay.
I think that gets into, you know, which method should be utilized.
Sure. It's fair because in this business, the jobs get built out first, and the company is paying all these expenses up front, and then it gets revenues down the road. And this isn't a situation where you could have a homeowner who's not going to pay. These are insurance claims. The insurer is going to pay down the road. And so there's a waterfall of payments that are coming in after the jobs are built. And once Mr. Flatham is terminated, as you touched on earlier, there's jobs that have already been built that are going to get paid for by the insurance company, but the money hasn't come in yet. So for that reason, it's fair. And I'd add something more to that. When the parties were doing the profit sharing for the few years before the relationship blew up, at the end of the year, they would do profit sharing bonuses. And when they calculated those bonuses, they would not only look at the bank account and say, what's the excess money in the bank account? They would also have a discussion about what money is coming in the door in the next year. And so there's a course of dealing aspect to this. The parties always took into account money that was going to come in, the accounts receivable, when determining profit sharing. So it is fair. From a bigger picture perspective, it still goes to the weight of the testimony. These are things that are fodder for cross-examination. They had an opportunity to cross-examine Mr. Shermack. They had an opportunity to make these arguments to the jury. It's not for the judge to decide whether cash basis or accrual basis accounting is proper in this case. Another piece that I want to mention about the expert testimony is that there's no prejudice that the appellant has raised about the admission of Mr. Shermack's testimony. And it's true that the jury adopted Mr. Shermack's number and awarded those damages to the cent. But there's no evidence in the record that Mr. Shermack's calculation was actually wrong, that if he had used a different methodology, he would have come to a different number, or that if he had used a different methodology, the number would have been lower. All they're saying is we don't like his methodology, but they're not showing any prejudice, how that actually changed the scope or outcome of the trial. And they need to show unfair prejudice to overturn an evidentiary ruling. My last points on that are points that Judge Cochran mentioned. They had an opportunity to cross-examine Mr. Shermack, and they had an opportunity to hire their own rebuttal expert to try to poke these same supposed holes in Mr. Shermack's testimony, and they chose not to engage a rebuttal expert. They did choose to cross-examine Mr. Shermack. I think there's 4 or 5 pages of transcript related to that. But they don't get a do-over now to try to cross-examine him more thoroughly, and they don't get a do-over to hire a rebuttal expert now or to make challenges now that they should have made before the district court. If the court has no further questions, I will conclude my argument.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any rebuttal?
Just briefly, Judge. First, I'm going to correct my misstatement as to closing argument. I had the same problem you had, Judge. I didn't read the closing argument until late in the case, and my analysis of the case didn't focus much on it. Our position, trial counsel is with me. She tells me that our position on closing was that because so many jobs had canceled, Tony Flatham had been paid what he was entitled to up to termination. So that was the position as at closing. And what I would tell you now as the appellate advocate is if that's not true, if the number of jobs that had canceled didn't sufficiently counterweight jobs that were still out there waiting to be paid, there would have been some money owed. The issue here is not really, as I say, as to whether damages should have been awarded. There's an issue as to the way that they were calculated by the plaintiff's expert.
Wasn't there a cross-examination about these cancellations, if there were?
There was. There was, in fact, cross-examination about it. It's a fact issue, and we're not here on appeal. With respect to that issue. Also, Judge Hooten, you asked me about the motion in limine. Now, I got to depend on my own analysis, but I like to think I'm pretty careful when I read the record. And what I said at page 10 of the reply brief, going over to page 11, is that, in fact, Jovan's motion in limine specified an objection to Trimec's use of a limited sample of Protex cap sheets to determine profitability. And I cite our memorandum of law in support of defendant's motion in limine at page 2. That's document 203. And I want to be very frank with you about what my analysis of the record is with respect to the state of objections. I don't want to hide anything from you. That objection was made, and it was definitively ruled upon by the trial judge, who allowed the testimony regardless, and said he was, and said that he, that she was going to. Actually, the trial judge changed from the motion in limine to the trial itself. That objection was made. Objections as to the broader methodology, the use of accrual-based accounting to analyze a cash-based business, that objection, counsel tells me, was made out of the jury's hearing and did not make it into the record. So that objection is not of record. That means that the court will have to analyze that objection probably under a plain error standard.
I take it there's no issues about whether the expert's opinions were sufficiently disclosed. I mean, there was a report pre-trial?
Not that I'm aware of, Judge.
Yeah.
Our issues with expert Chermak go exclusively to foundation, the use of the accrual-based method, and the use of a calculation methodology that was ill-founded and inflated as a result. And then the prejudice, which is a separate issue, simply lies in the impact of the opinion, which is obvious because the jury awarded exactly what the expert said. I do want to briefly, I mean, the most important issue, I think, before you right now at oral argument is the question of reviewability. And I assert that you do have discretion to review the issue, and I assert that this case does meet the Watson factors. But I also want to briefly touch on this court's ability to adopt new law. There isn't anybody who does this with any regularity who doesn't understand that this court is an error-correcting court. But inside the acknowledged confines of that, you do have latitude. You must, it's necessary latitude, to say what the law is. And this is an ill-defined area of law, the area of promoter liability.
You haven't cited any Minnesota case law to support your position on promoter liability.
I would say, Judge, that the closest we can come to that, so I think the short answer is no, we haven't. But in a way, we have. This court's dicta in Almack in 1986, and by the way, that's all it was, because Almack was decided on the basis of the de facto corporation theory, which is now, which is no longer the law. This court's decision in Almack indicates that the parties can agree that the promoter will not be liable going forward. From my perspective, that is a version of the well-accepted, actually uniformly accepted, exception for pre-incorporation contracts that are made in the sole credit of the corporation. That's, I would assert that's a different way of saying that. But if it's not, it's a very short step, a tiny extension of Minnesota law to accept that exception, that contracts made on the sole credit of the corporation do not subject the promoter to liability. I am blinking red, so I'll stop.
All right, thank you very much. We appreciate your arguments here today, and we'll look carefully at the issues in this case.
Thank you, Judge.